Welcome to the Shortwave Report for March 23rd, 2012. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcasts at home is quite easy. You just need a shortwave radio with a schedule of English language broadcast or a computer with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's www.outfarpress.com, you can find a schedule for dozens of international broadcasters in English. There you can also listen to the past five shortwave reports, find advice for listening to shortwave at home, and find internet links for global news sources. Please check it out and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from Spanish National Radio, Radio Havana Cuba, NHK World Radio Japan, China Radio International, and The Voice of Russia. We'll begin with Spanish National Radio. First, a press review from El País on the state of culture in an economic crisis. On the 9th anniversary of the start of the U.S. invasion of Iraq, there were more than 30 bomb attacks across the country. Russia and the Red Cross are pushing for daily ceasefires in Syria, while Saudi Arabia began delivering more military equipment to rebel forces. Human Rights Watch accused rebels of human rights abuses. Amnesty International says that NATO has failed to investigate the civilian deaths its bombing raids in Libya caused. Spanish National Radio.
El País carries a front-page story on the state of culture in Spain during these times of economic convulsion under the headline, Spanish Culture Lives Its Worst Moment, fenced in by the crisis. The model of cultural management, as we've known it over the past few decades, is dead, the paper says, and backs its claim with the testimonies of workers and artists in the editorial, theatrical, cinematographic, and music industries. Museums are holding fewer exhibitions and sending their collections out on loan. Concerts are being eliminated from local and regional programming. Filmmaking is going underground or collapsing, and everyone agrees on a single solution: the need to reinvent oneself, one's work, and the relationship of one's art to the world.
In what appears to have been a carefully coordinated campaign of violence, more than 30 bombs struck towns across Iraq today, killing at least 52 people and wounding about 250. It was Iraq's bloodiest day in nearly a month. Officials say two car bombs in the predominantly Shia city of Karbala killed at least 13 people. Another car bomb near police headquarters in the northern city of Kirkuk killed another 13 people, most of them officers. Most of the blast targeted police checkpoints and patrols.
The attacks come ahead of next week's Arab League summit to be held in the capital, Baghdad. Security forces in Iraq have been placed on high alert in the run-up. The attacks also coincide with the 9th anniversary of the beginning of the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq. The summit is seen as the country's return to the regional stage following the withdrawal of U.S. troops in December.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has condemned the Syrian government, but at the same time reiterated his view that President Bashar al-Assad's exit should not be a precondition for a solution to the crisis. Earlier, Russia announced that it is ready to support a United Nations revolution, endorsing a plan by a UN Arab League special joint envoy, Kofi Annan, for settling the Syrian crisis. Mr. Annan's plans have not been made public, but Russia's foreign minister warned that the resolution should not turn into an ultimatum to the Syrian government. Yesterday, Russia joined the Red Cross in asking Syria to ensure a daily ceasefire to allow humanitarian access.
For its part, Saudi Arabia said it has begun delivering military equipment to arm the Free Syrian Army in its fight against the Assad regime. The announcement comes just days after the Saudis shut down their embassy in Syria and withdrew all its staff. Meanwhile, a new report by Human Rights Watch accuses armed opposition groups in Syria of carrying out serious human rights abuses, including kidnapping, detention, and torture of security force members, government supporters, and people identified as members of pro-government militia. The human rights organization has also received reports of executions by armed opposition groups. Amnesty International has accused NATO of failing to investigate the killings of dozens of civilians during its air campaign in Libya last year. Amnesty has also called on NATO to provide reparations to the people affected. Donatella Rovera of Amnesty International said victims and relatives of those killed by NATO airstrikes remain in the dark about what happened and who was responsible.
A year ago today, U.S. and British forces fired more than 110 Tomahawk cruise missiles, marking the beginning of 7 months of NATO airstrikes.
Those reports were from Spanish National Radio, heard from 5 to 6 p.m. at 5970, and podcasting at www.rtve.es. All the times I'm announcing are for Pacific Daylight Saving Time, so adjust them to your time zone. Next, Radio Havana, Cuba. The Syrian foreign minister denounced foreign governments for support given to the rebels in his country. Chilean student protests have extended around the country. Argentinian President Fernandez wants South America to unite to demilitarize the South Atlantic zone and defend the natural resources of the region. Bolivian President Morales has threatened to close the U.S. embassy if espionage and interference continues. Radio Havana, Cuba.
The Syrian foreign minister denounced the support given to terrorists by foreign governments, which he called a flagrant violation of the United Nations Charter and international laws. In a message released in Damascus, the foreign minister stated that the recent terrorist attacks in the capital and the city of Aleppo targeted calm and stable suburbs and caused the death of around 30 people and more than 100 were wounded. National media also informed that Syrian authorities denied reports about the supposed arrival of Russian Navy ships at Syrian ports with military supplies to combat terrorism. Libyan Foreign Minister Alnan Mansour said he is in agreement with Russia about not getting involved in Syria's internal affairs. During a meeting in Moscow with his Russian counterpart, Sergei Lavrov, Mansour warned that the situation in the Syrian territory could get worse if it spreads to its neighbors.
The Confederation of Students of Chile called for a demonstration today in solidarity with the people of the region of Aysén and against police violence in the area. The University Federations grouped in that organization stated that in addition to the demonstration in Santiago de Chile, the capital, there will be similar demonstrations in other cities such as Valparaíso, Concepción, Temuco, Puerto Montt, and Coyhaique. Meanwhile, social leaders of Aysén denounced of the brutal repression new special forces troops who arrived in the region of Patagonia and the isolation of the place by the cuts in the telecommunications network.
Argentinian President Cristina Fernandez asked to join forces within South America so the South Atlantic can become an absolutely demilitarized zone. The head of state made the call to the participants at the first Latin American Telecommunications, Culture and Digital Inclusion, Patria Grande Conectada, held in Buenos Aires. Cristina Fernandez also praised the Peruvian government's decision to rescind a visit from the warship from Britain to El Callao naval base this week for reasons of Latin American solidarity with the legitimate rights of Argentina over the Malvinas Islands. The president of Argentina also urged to defend the natural resources of the region and stressed that the nations of the area do not want the problems of war that the great powers impose on the world. Bolivian President Evo Morales has warned the U.S. not to continue bothering his country and threatened to close its embassy in La Paz in response to provocations. Morales gave his warning during a regional meeting of the Governing Movement Towards Socialism, MAS, party in the central city of Cochabamba. The Bolivian leader, quoted by the local media, said, "I want to give this warning publicly. I have no fear. If the U.S. Embassy continues to bother Bolivia, as it has been doing so far, I warn you, we'll close the U.S. Embassy in Bolivia, because we are anti-imperialist, anti-capitalist, and anti-neoliberalism." Last month, President Morales insisted on his allegations, claiming that some non-governmental organizations are closely linked to the U.S. espionage activities, despite the signing in November of an agreement aimed at normalizing relations between the two countries. According to the state-run Bolivian Information Agency, ABI, President Evo Morales also said the right wing of his country has no policy proposals and therefore accepts to participate in any conflict, not only in Bolivia, but also in other countries like Ecuador.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba, heard from 2 p.m. to 3 at 11760 and from 4 to 11 p.m. at either 6060, 6010, or 6000. Also streaming on the web from 4 to 11 p.m. at www.radiohz.cu and now podcasting at World Radio Network, WRN.org. On to NHK World Radio Japan. The United States is planning a major military shift out of Japan. Japan's defense ministry is considering using missiles against a North Korean satellite launch next month. Then an insight segment on the rethinking of Japanese reliance on nuclear energy. The British government is lifting restrictions on the export of sheep meat, which has been in place since the 1986 Chernobyl nuclear disaster. NHK Japan.
The United States is planning a major military shift out of Japan. About 4,000 Marines will be transferred out of Okinawa to Guam. 5,000 others will be sent to Hawaii, Australia, and other locations. The U.S. government is making final adjustments with the Japanese government as part of its planned realignment of military in Japan. Previously, the U.S. government had proposed the transfer of 8,000 Marines from Okinawa to Guam. The two governments have agreed to keep this transfer separate from the planned relocation of a U.S. Marine Corps air station in Okinawa. They had previously been working on the two deals in tandem. The two governments say, in order to maintain security in the region, they're negotiating to keep about 10,000 Marines in Okinawa. Officials will meet in San Francisco on Friday to work out a broad transfer plan. They want to complete an interim report by late April when Prime Minister Yoshihiko Noda plans to visit the U.S.
Japan's defense ministry is considering deploying missile interceptors in Okinawa Prefecture to prepare for an expected North Korean satellite launch next month. Defense Minister Naoki Tanaka told reporters on Wednesday the ministry is considering placing surface-to-air PAC-3 Patriot missiles and Aegis-equipped destroyers in areas of the southern Japanese island chain in the expected path of the rocket. Asked whether deployment would be on the main island of Okinawa and in Sakishima island chain, Tanaka said these locations are being considered. North Korea announced last week that it's calling a satellite launch between April 12th and 16th.
The meltdowns at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant have prompted a rethink of Japan's reliance on nuclear power. The Japanese government is currently re-examining the country's future energy policy. Nuclear power has been an important source of energy in Japan for decades. But since the accident at the Fukushima Daiichi plant, a number of alternatives have attracted greater interest, something that some businesses see as an opportunity. In today's edition of Insight, we hear from NHK World's Chie Yamagishi on the prospects for non-nuclear energy sources. Can you tell us about some of the private initiatives involving renewable sources of energy?
While Japan's future energy policy remains unclear, momentum has been growing in the field of renewable energy since last year's nuclear plant disaster. One area of interest is so-called mega solar power facilities that can generate more than 1 megawatt or 1 million watts of power. Japan's third largest mobile phone service company, SoftBank, was among the first to announce plans to branch out into this business after the nuclear accident. Last December, SoftBank built three experimental solar power facilities on Japan's northernmost mainland island of Hokkaido. Future plans include construction of more than 10 mega solar plants capable of producing more than 200 megawatts in total. SoftBank chairman Masayoshi Son says he aims to create a model of renewable energy use that will act as an example and will encourage other companies to follow suit.
How is the government responding to these and similar developments?
Some changes to energy policy are in the pipeline. Beginning in July, the government plans to require utility firms to buy all electricity generated from renewable energy sources at fixed prices over a predetermined time period. Meanwhile, one financial institution is trying to help promote the use of renewable energy sources and encourage energy saving in Japanese households. Jonan Shinkin Bank, which ranks second among credit unions in Japan in terms of deposits, has switched to LED lighting to save energy. It has also changed its energy supplier to one that doesn't use nuclear power. For buyers of energy-saving equipment like solar panels, LEDs, and storage cells, the credit union has started a high-interest time deposit service and a loan service with no interest in the first year. Bank President Tsuyoshi Yoshiwara says the Fukushima Daiichi accident made him recognize the formidable risk associated with nuclear power and inspire the institution's new policy. Today, the government finds itself under pressure to respond to corporate efforts to spread the use of alternative energy. Many Japanese people are behind these efforts and believe that it is time for the government to make its own moves in the same direction.
In today's edition of Insight, we heard the comments of NHK World's Chie Yamagishi on the changing landscape of energy supply in Japan.
The British government is lifting all restrictions on shipments of sheep meat, which were put in place after the 1986 Chernobyl nuclear accident. The government said on Tuesday the food safety provision still in place in some parts of Britain will be removed on June 1st. The provision requires testing of sheep for radiation before farmers can take them to market. It bans the shipment of meat containing radioactive substances above the government limit. The restrictions were introduced following the Chernobyl accident in the former Soviet Union when high levels of radiation were detected in sheep raised on grass in Wales and some other parts of Britain. Fallout from the accident affected wide areas of Europe. The British government says it has now scientifically confirmed that sheep meat from areas still under the restrictions is safe to eat. An association of farmers in Britain has urged the government to clearly explain the reasons for lifting the restrictions to avoid causing public anxiety.
Those reports were from NHK World Radio Japan, heard from 9 to 9:30 p.m. at 6110 or on the web at www.nhk.or.jp. Next, China Radio International. In defense of its economic practices, China points out that it is the second largest importer of goods and that it will soon be the largest. The Afghan government is renewing its offer of holding talks with the Taliban. A five-year research project in China shows that traditional Chinese medicine has proven to be a cost-effective HIV/AIDS treatment. China Radio International.
Chen Deming made the remarks when addressing at the China Development Forum 2012 in Beijing.
西方的政客批评中国不顾全球的平衡.
Many Western politicians blame China for global trade imbalance, but they seldom mentioned that China is also the world's second largest importer. China will become the biggest one in a few years. As to the import volume, we have a very short distance to the world's largest importer. China can become the world's largest domestic market in the next few years.
Chen Deming said the growth rate of China's retail sales stayed between 16% and 18% over recent years, higher than its GDP growth, indicating the country's huge purchasing potential. Chen added, trade remedy measures taken by some developed countries are undesirable because they are neither fair to other economies nor fair to domestic citizens and enterprises.
The United States said repeatedly that they would open the market and they would make an open market policy to China. I have been listening to this for 3 years without seeing any practical actions taken. In the past, at least I could hear the sound of steps, though seeing no people stepping downstairs. But now, I cannot even hear the sound.
On rare earth trade, the minister also expressed his opinion.
We sell our rare earth to the United States, and the country puts our rare earth into its commodities. Then it says that exporting its commodities to China is unfavorable to its security. Is exporting our rare earth to the United States good for China's security?
Chen said many Western politicians blamed China for global trade imbalance, but they seldom mentioned that China, with its population accounting for 19% of the world total, is also the world's second largest importer. He noted that emerging countries should base their growth on domestic demand so as to balance its growth, while opening their markets and facilitating trade in line with national conditions. Customs data shows that China's trade surplus narrowed 14.5% year-on-year to $155.14 billion in 2011, with imports up 25% to $1.74 trillion. The week-long China Development Forum 2012 on the theme of China and the World, Macro-Stabilization and Economic Restructuring wrapped up Monday. For CRI, this is Wei Tong.
The Afghan government is now renewing its offer of talks with the Taliban. Afghan Vice President Mohammad Kazim Fahim says the country is still open to negotiate with the militants who renounce violence and accept the constitution. However, Fahim says core issues including freedom of the press, human rights and the rights of women cannot be compromised. The Afghan Taliban suspended talks on establishing a liaison office in Qatar following a recent shooting spree near a US military base in which 16 Afghan civilians were killed. A 5-year research project in China reveals traditional Chinese medicine, or TCM, has proven a cost-effective HIV/AIDS treatment that enhances patients' immunity and improves the quality of their lives. More than 300 HIV/AIDS patients in southwest China's Sichuan province were enlisted as volunteers in the research program that began in 2006.
Those reports were from China Radio International, heard from 4 to 5 p.m. at 11970, and from 6 p.m. to 11 at either 9790, 6020, or 6190, or on the web at english.cri.cn. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or would like to make a donation for production cost of this unfunded program, I may be reached through the website or by writing to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. Donations are the only financial support I receive for producing this program. Please help if you can. We will conclude with the voice of Russia. The United States is fast-tracking research into cyber weapons, including using radio waves to infiltrate computer systems which are isolated from networks. The Voice of Russia.
The U.S. is fast-tracking research into cyber weapons, including advanced next-generation weapon technology that is able to attack enemy networks, even if they are not connected to the Internet. And being able to target enemy technology offline is the final goal of the Pentagon research and development. According to the Washington Post, the Pentagon considers cyber weapons to be the new essential tool when it comes to conflict, especially in light of a possible confrontation in Syria or Iran.
However, the development of such offline military offensive systems that would transmit damaging codes on radio waves is already in the works. The U.S.'s military's Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency recently secured $500 million in funding for such a project, as well as several other fast-track initiatives. Meanwhile, the Senate is developing a legal base which would allow the U.S. military to develop and purchase weapons whenever and wherever new real or perceived threats emerge.
Aggressive codes transmitted on the radio would need to be customized in order to have the right effect on enemy targets. Joel Harding, an independent consultant and former director of the Information Operations Institute, told the Post that remotely attacking an offline system is still the stuff of the future. He said, "To affect a system, you have to have access to it, and we have not perfected the capability of reaching out and accessing a system that is not connected to the Internet."
And even if you do secure the access, Harding said, "Unless you already have custom-written code for a system, chances are we don't have a weapon for that because each system has different software and updates." In some cases, the attacker would have to physically insert the code into the enemy system through, for example, a USB stick. In cases like Syria, simply getting there is already problematic.
The Pentagon is spending increasingly larger sums of money on cybersecurity. This year alone, the U.S. military secured some $3.4 billion on its cyber projects. This includes $154 million for the department's new cyber command in Fort Meade. Set up in 2010, the cyber command became the first of its kind focused entirely on network warfare, although the spending is still concentrated on defense rather than the development of offensive technologies that are either too unpredictable or too dangerous to consider. Deputy Secretary of Defense Ashton Carter said last month that the U.S. would spend a lot more on cyber if it knew where to spend it.
The new cyber command was launched as a response to increasing number of attacks on the U.S. military in the recent years, particularly against its transportation command, which is responsible for getting the troops out of Iraq and Afghanistan and back to the United States. Despite the intensified frequency and audaciousness of the attacks, there is still no consensus on whether and how, and indeed against whom exactly, the U.S. could engage in a real cyber war, for which a separate policy would need to be developed.
Senate Armed Services Committee Chairman Carl Levin said during a Senate hearing in March, the most difficult strategic challenge facing the United States in the realm of cyber warfare is distinguishing between cyber espionage, intrusions, and potentially disruptive attacks, and providing timely warning of cyber threats and incidents. We would need some way of bringing to a resolution that issue, so we can have some criteria to determine whether the nation is under military attack that needs a response or a military-like attack that requires a response.
The world's first government-backed digital attack was the Stuxnet worm, believed to have been jointly developed by the U.S. and Israel to disrupt Iran's nuclear facility at Bushehr in 2009 and 2010. However, Stuxnet, although it succeeded at temporarily disabling the facility, was said to be too imprecise and unpredictable to become an example for future cyber warfare. The new generation of cyber warfare is thought to be more advanced, using a fundamentally different approach than Stuxnet, said an unnamed military official. He continued, "If I'm trying to knock down an air defense system, I have to know precisely what is going to happen and when it will happen."
The U.S. military was also looking for ways to make use of cyber weapons during the campaign in Libya, in particular to disable the country's air defenses, but had to cancel their plans when they realized it would take more than a year to develop the necessary weapon. A former U.S. official who spoke to the Post on the condition of anonymity said, "We weren't ready to do that in Libya. We're not ready to do that now either." Using cyber technology was also contemplated in the Iraqi campaign to freeze Saddam Hussein's bank accounts prior to the 2003 invasion.
That report was from the Voice of Russia. Russia is now heard from 6 p.m. to 10 at 12030-13665. 9840 and 7250, or through their website www.english.ruvr.ru. All the times I've announced are for Pacific Daylight Saving Time. Please adjust them to your time zone. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people to listen to international broadcast using a shortwave radio at home. However, if you use the internet, listening globally is also quite easy. See the links at this program's website. Every Friday morning, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's www.outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows, find internet links for international broadcasters, make a safe donation through PayPal, and get advice for listening at home. The shortwave report is free to rebroadcast upon notification. The shortwave report is produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.